that makes me know that we had the right idea in the beginning, and we just need to maintain our focus and elevate. We update our formulas. We have certain formulas, but we update them with the times and everything, you know. And so.
Hello, my basketball friends, and welcome to the Teardrop Runners. This is the story of four Seattle friends who scattered to the winds when the Sonics left town. Now we huddle together on the internet and talk about the entire league. So I apologize on the very off chance someone listening to this is a Kings fan or a resident of Sacramento, because we're going to be talking about at least one Sonic to be this week. I'm your host, Scott, right now in a city that's headed for a wild weekend, win or lose, Baltimore. And with us, as always, are...
Anzel B. out in Brooklyn.
Chris Brown in Gaithersburg, Maryland.
Big Shot, Lower East Side, Manhattan. How you doing, fellas?
What's up, Rob? How you doing?
Hey, dude.
Fantastically well.
Did everybody have a good weekend?
Oh, yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Always have a good weekend. It's Monday I worry about.
Mondays are tough, man. ask Garfield about it. He'll tell you.
At least he had the comfort of warm lasagna.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I've been living off English muffins and peanut butter.
What is that? What you had for dinner tonight?
I haven't had dinner tonight, believe it or not.
Oh, that's sad.
But I will have a snack of that sort later.
Very Dickensian.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, let's jump right into the hoops analytics talk this week. We are going to be talking about a statistical concept that you hear bandied about sometime in very sophisticated circles, which is why I'm going to turn it over to Manzel to talk about the four factors. Manzel, what are the four factors and what are they used for?
The four factors are kind of what are thought to be the most important stats when it comes to winning and losing basketball games. So we have stats for individual players or teams that are rolled up numbers that represent, you know, those per things like that. But the four factors are really what have been identified as the most important basic stats towards winning basketball, and what they are in order of how important to how not important they are. Well, they're all important, but one is shooting percentage, basically effective field goal percentage, which we talked about last week.
And when you're talking about the percentage, you're talking about the percentage for the entire team, right?
For the team, yes. Turnovers, rebounding, and especially offensive rebounds. And then free throws, and there's some debate whether you should really be looking at free throw rate or free throw attempts, et cetera, but basically getting to the line is important as the takeaway there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you said that they were actually ranked in a certain order. Why is that?
Well, so what they do is they look at how a team performs in each of those stats, and it correlates that with winning. So teams, when they shoot a better percentage or effective field goal percentage than the other team, are very liable to win. Now, you can lose if you have a lot of turnovers, you can't offensive board, et cetera. But what they found is of those stats, that the relationship between a good EFG and winning is the strongest.
Okay. And so that's weighted the most in this calculus.
Yeah, the different analysts have different formulas for weighting those, you know, whether they rate shooting at a 10 share or 40% like Dean Oliver does. There's a lot of differences and differences of opinion there. But everyone's in agreement that shooting is the most important one.
Yeah.
All right.
So just to kind of chip in to what Manzel or add to what Manzel was saying, while shooting is number one, turnovers are generally thought to be the second most important component. Third most important component is offensive rebounding percentage. And fourth is getting to the foul line. And just, you know, as weights go, if shooting percentage is the number 10, turnovers per possession are rated by Dean Oliver, at least, as a 5 or 6. Offensive rebounding percentage is a 4 or 5. Getting to the foul line is a 2 or 3.
And just for the people that don't know, Dean Oliver is the author of what's considered probably the early seminal work on basketball analytics. The book is called Basketball on Paper. And so he was one of the first kind of to take this approach.
Yeah, that's correct. The other point I'd like to make about the statistic is that it's not just sort of these shooting percentages, turnovers per possession, etc., aren't just for the team that is on offense. You have another set of four numbers that are for the team on defense. And so really, really what you're seeing when you look at this statistic is 8 different measurements. A measurement of what a team is doing on offense in terms of a shooting percentage. Also another measure of what they're holding their opponent to in terms of shooting percentage. So when you hear that, you know, shooting percentage is a big stat, it's a big stat both offensively for a team, but just as big defensively as well.
Right. Yep. So you have a team like Indiana who's just terrible at scoring but really good at defense and still up there in terms of efficiency.
Yeah.
And when you say shooting percentage, we're talking again about effective field goal percentage, right?
That is correct, yeah. So this is a measure of shooting percentage that adds points or bonus to teams that hit from three-point land.
So, Manziel, who's at the top in the four factors?
Well, that's a great question.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, Manziel. You're a good friend.
It's impossible to really say, you know, who's at the top. This doesn't all boil down into just one number.
Mm-hmm.
But what it does tell you is kind of the mode of how teams do in terms of generating their offense or their defense. So ultimately, they do boil down to your offensive and defensive efficiency ratings. But within that, you can look at a team and say that this is a team that excels because they're able to get to the line a lot, or this is a team that excels because they don't turn the ball over. So that's like the New York
Knicks. All right. Let's talk about a team that gets to the line a lot but still doesn't win. Looks to me like the top in free throw rate differential are the Los Angeles Lakers.
Well, I mean, it's the fourth rated of those metrics there.
Okay. So that even though they're number one in one of the four most important factors, they're deficient in so many other ways that being that great at one thing is not good enough to save them, right?
I also think, yeah, I think their free throw rate is a lot higher because they just don't play defense and give up free layups all the time.
Yeah, their issues are really the defensive.
You know, I don't know if this is the case for the Lakers, but it might not necessarily measure made free throws. It's possible that a team could accumulate a lot of free throw attempts and yet not score them. And so if the statistic is based on attempts, there might be a divergence.
It's only based on attempts, right? Isn't that right? It's the free throw rate is about the team's ability to get to the line. It doesn't reflect how well they do once they get there. Isn't that right?
There's two ways to do this. Some analysts go with the free throws made. Some go with free throws attempted.
Okay.
So it's a difference of opinion. I tend to think it's probably free throws attempted might be better to use, but there's room in there for both sides of that debate.
Well, the good news is that free throws are very unimportant to the game of basketball, at least when we look at the four factors approach. And so, you know, even if there's some error in that metric, then the effective field goal offensive and defensive percentages will kind of overwhelm it. By the way, that was a total joke.
No, yeah.
Guys, feel free to laugh.
You know, the Lakers are a team that, despite the struggles, do have a positive point differential on the season.
Mm-hmm.
They've been very unlucky along with some of the other stuff that's going on there.
Well, so who are some of the standout teams in some of the four factors?
Well, the Knicks obviously are doing a great job this season of not turning the ball over whatsoever. Let me pull up the numbers here.
Oak City looks great. I mean, that's a team that is really is best in the league in terms of offensive and defensive efficiencies. By that, it's driven heavily by their effective field goal percentage. They score and they prevent teams from scoring.
Right.
So at this time, their offensive effective field goal percentage rate is 52.7. Defensively, they're 47.4. So their differential there is 5.2. So that's really allowing them to score a lot of points and prevent their opponent from scoring a lot, and it's helping them win a lot of games.
But what's interesting about Oklahoma City is that they're, again, we've talked about this earlier in the season, but in the turnover rate, they're down near the bottom. They're 23rd in differential.
That's correct. The other thing that they do pretty well is they do a decent job at getting offensive rebounds. So they're basically as aggressive going to the offensive glass. You know, that's a positive for them.
Yeah, they got Russell Westbrook, who's an amazing offensive rebounding.
Yep.
You know, and they also get to a line a ton. I think Kevin Durant has led the league in free throw attempts a few of the last couple of years off the top of my head.
Another team that does well using four factors type analysis is San Antonio Spurs. So sure. They're actually best in the league in terms if you look at effective field goal percentage differential. So they do, that again is the most important of the four factors in terms of determining whether a team wins or loses. So they're positive 6.5% on the season. One thing that they don't do as well as Oak City, though, is that they really don't do particularly well on the offensive glass. You know, that's a major component of four factors analysis, and that may be one of the reasons why they're ranked number two in the league, despite having the best in the league effective field goal percentage differential.
Right, but Chris, don't you think that a lot of that's coaching? Like, I think part of why they're highest in effective field goal percentage is I think Pop's a better coach and they're taking good shots. And then in terms of offensive rebounding, since they are, for the most part, older, you know, he has them, I think he has them go back so they don't give up any easy buckets. Isn't that more
yeah.
maybe a coaching thing?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I think that just the style that a team plays has a big effect on the components that show up. As you say, teams that don't want to play a transition game or are reluctant to get into a transition game are probably not going to pursue offensive rebounds as aggressively as a team with younger players. So yeah, I mean, that's an excellent point. You know, one of the interesting aspects is that you can really see the style of play of teams, how they differ by, you know, what components are better than others.
Can you give me an example of that, Chris?
Well, you know, for example, the one that Rob mentioned. So oftentimes, older teams prefer not to play a transition game, so they don't go after offensive rebounds as much. So, for example, San Antonio is a negative 4%. A team that's a little bit counterintuitive there is Dallas. Actually, Dallas is negative 6.8 in terms of offensive rebound rate. They're a team that, for what you know, even though they're a team that likes to play the transition game, loves to turn guys over and you know run the court on them, they're really reluctant to pursue their own offensive rebounds,
right,
according to four factors analysis.
And it should come as no surprise to anyone that Miami is also near the bottom of the league in at or near the bottom, depending on how you measure it, in offensive rebound or the rebounding rate.
So do you guys, question for you guys, do you have any like one or two guesses about teams in the league that might be very good at offensive rebounding?
I mean, Denver's...
I'd go with Memphis, but I mean, they have two huge guys who love to get putbacks. And Gasol and Randolph.
Yep. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, Minnesota's up there too.
You know, Scott said Denver. You're absolutely right. Denver is positive. They're one of the teams that's quite high in the league in terms of aggressively going after offensive rebounds. So I imagine in Denver's case, I mean, even if we don't know much about Denver, we can think, boy, this is a team that probably plays at altitude. You know, knowing sort of George Karl's history with you know, being willing to play a deep bench and liking guys that can get out and transition, it kind of makes sense, really, that team would have, you know, an offensive rebounding rate that high.
Sure, and then if you switch it over and look at a team like Memphis, if you want to talk about looking at the identity of a team through the four factors, even though I think a lot of people consider Memphis at least a fringe contender, they do not have a very good effective field goal differential. They're near the they're in the bottom 10 of the league with a minus 1.48 effective field goal differential. And you know, they're the only kind of legitimate contender that's down in that range. Brooklyn's.
And that's why that's one of the ways I think that you can use this data. So, you know, we've heard a lot of talk about they want to trade Rudy Gay and they need some outside shooting. You know, you look at this and you can see that, you know, Memphis excellent rebounding. Let's see, where are they on free throw differential? A little bit low. The turnovers are excellent taking care of the ball. So you look and think, okay, that, you know, that's the most leverage they have is to increase that, the effective field goal rate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to do that, you probably basically need to shoot.
Right.
Yeah.
So something that jumps out with me is I looked at 2011, 2012 to just, you know, have a larger sample size. And, you know, up at the top is Chicago, Spurs, Miami, OKC. And Philly rounds out the top five. Obviously, Chicago with D-Rose, they got hurt pretty bad, and then they lost to Philly, who had quite the run last year. A very big surprise to everybody. But seeing that they're fifth overall makes me think that this is a very valid measurement in terms of how, you know, how good teams are. And if you look at this year, you know, judging by, you know, just if you just they're almost directly correlated to records. And you see, like, the Lakers might be a little higher. They're at 13 right now. And while they're, you know, 6-7 games below 500, they still are outscoring their opponents. So that, you know, that almost says that maybe they've been a little bit unlucky. And then on the flip side, another team like Portland, who's played a ton of close games, they're actually 500, but they're further down on the list. They're down at 20.
Hmm.
21. Or at least this year, yeah. 21, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, the Lakers are at 11, and Portland's at 21, but they have a much better record. Those are the two outliers in my mind right now.
All right.
And the Lakers have been playing better basketball as of late, so you think that, you know, maybe there is a chance that they can sneak up a little bit.
And they do have a guy that's, well, frankly, he's a popular guy to foul on their team.
Yeah. The other sort of, you know, one of the, talking about the four factors, you know, one of the strengths of a four factors type analysis, as you mentioned, Rob, is that it really is kind of predictive, and it can sort of be useful for sort of looking at, you know, what a team might do in the future, divorced from their wins and losses in the past. By that, I mean, you can really look at these kind of fundamental measures of team performance. And a lot of times in the short term, they may not correlate strongly to wins and losses, but over the course of the season, they should actually do a very good job of predicting wins and losses. The other thing is, if I were, you know, I'm not a big fan of gambling. It's just something I'm not good at or comfortable with. I don't like the risk of it. But if I were to gamble, I think that basing a lot of bets, maybe small bets over a long period of time, based on a four factors analysis versus the team's sort of record of wins and losses, may allow for a gambler to win.
You'd have to bet the money line, not the spread, though. The spread adds an extra layer of luck into that, right?
I mean, I don't know this for professional basketball, but what I've seen is that oftentimes for college basketball, and by the way, this is an opportunity to kind of give a shout out to another great collegiate basketball website, heavily dependent on four factors analysis, is KenPom.com. He's had these types of statistics available since early 2000, say 2003. And what you often see is that, like, college basketball teams that do really well with four factors types analysis are often not ranked particularly highly in the polls and are often underseeded heavily in the NCAA bracket. And these teams, you know, routinely make upsets happen. You know, if one were to, say, bet on Ken Palm four factors type rankings, versus, you know, how the bookies set lines and such, I think that my suspicion is that somebody would be able to make money doing that.
All right, listeners, go ahead and bookmark that for March Madness, and gamblers who don't already go there, do it now. That's Ken Palm, as in Pomeranian, .com. KenPalm.com. Not a sponsor.
Yeah.
All right, guys, any closing thoughts on these four factors before we get into our homework for the week?
So one thing that comes to mind is that while these four factors are excellent for sort of looking at team performance and maybe getting an understanding of styles of play that teams employ, they're not particularly good at – they actually don't give us any insight into how players affect these styles. So when you see you know, an effective field goal percentage of 50, it's not clear at all, you know, what the guys that are on the team or on the court are contributing, how they contribute to that.
Right.
And so
you mean, like, you know, a mid-range shooter versus a back-to-back basket scorer type?
Yeah, we don't know. I mean, you know, I don't see how you know, a team ranking with effective field goal percentage, like, how individuals contribute to that necessarily. Is it through, you know, we can guess, is it through three-point shooting, is it through two-point shooting, but is it through some guard that is really finding open guys and getting guys open shots? We don't have a lot of insight into the individual.
Although, you know, those stats are all stats that we keep for individuals too. So, or at least for, you know, for individuals while they're on the floor. So arguably, you know, it might be useful to go through and compare them. I know that the City blog has an individual four factors, essentially adjusted plus minus that they run. And maybe that's something we can take a look at sometime down the road, because it's quite interesting. Interesting.
I'm not familiar with it. I should check it out. Thank you.
Oh, you know what, Chris? You're welcome. And I'd like a shout out to Maggie Brown there. You raised a very well-mannered son. speaking of good parenting, it's time to get into homework. This week, we all decided to scout Isaiah Thomas, one of the rare players in the history of the NBA who's the second best player with his name. And that's honestly not the only reason why we chose him. This is tough to talk about as four guys that have lost a team, but it does look like the Sacramento Kings might be becoming the Seattle Supersonics. Rob, how do we feel about this? Tell me how to feel.
Oh, man. Besides really excited, I think we should make it very clear that, you know, we don't want to have anybody to have to go through what we did. And, you know, my apologies go out to the friends and family of the fans and players of the Sacramento Kings, because I know it's not easy. You know, unfortunately, this is the way the NBA is run, and we're pretty much not having a team, or we're essentially hijacking your team. So I think I'd like to make a formal apology to all of our Sacramento listeners. You know, we're not happy about it, but I can't say we are absolutely thrilled that we're going to have a basketball team soon, and I'm all jacked up on Minotaur. I'm so excited.
It is very exciting, and we feel bad for Sacramento, but they've been a great basketball team and a great basketball town, other than the name of their arena. Just a tip to future NBA teams, when the highest bidder for the naming rights is the Sleep Train Corporation, you should probably go with the second highest bidder for the naming rights.
I'm not sure that was an option.
They might not have had a second bidder. They may have only had one suitor. Anyway, let's get back to Isaiah. Chris and I were in a bar argument the other night. You ever been in a bar argument, Craig? Anyway, the argument was about where to rank Isaiah Thomas among current NBA point guards. Now, Mario Chalmers made news today by saying that not only is Mario in the top 10, but he considers himself somewhere in the middle of the top 10. Huh. Now, in our intoxicated state this weekend, Chris and I were maybe arguing that Isaiah might be in that same general range. Chris, after watching him this week, reading up, and having had a chance to sober up, what do you think about that assessment now?
So I've gone from being fairly sure last weekend to unsure right now. So he's a mixture of good things and exciting potential, and there's also a statistical case to be made that perhaps he's not as good as he looks, and that actually, you know, the Sonics, the new Sonics, the old Sacramento team, is really just not a very good team. And so it's difficult to judge sort of the talents of the players that are on it because of the fact that the entire team is terrible, frankly.
Right.
But,
I think we can just call them the Kings for the time being.
Either is acceptable.
Okay. So I'll just sort of talk about, I've actually watched Isaiah Thomas for a long time. I was a University of Washington basketball student season ticket holder when Isaiah was playing for the Huskies. And I've since that time followed him closely in the league. He's an interesting player. He's a guy that I kind of like just because has small stature. He's never been one of the guys that has been considered to be the most talented or the most athletic guy, but he just gets it done. He's been incredibly productive over his collegiate and his professional career.
When you say small of stature, exactly how tall do you think he really is? They list him as 5'9". Is he 5'9", Chris?
So I think he's probably a little shorter than that, frankly, though I've never seen him. I mean, I've never stood next to him in person, and so it's difficult for me to judge against guys that are on the court when I'm in the crowd. My thought is that he's about as tall as Nate Robinson is, and I'm at least 2 inches taller than Nate.
Right. Having dunked on him many times.
Yeah, that's right. So he is a short guy, basically.
Well, how tall are you, Chris?
I'm about 5'10". 5'9 and a half, 5'10". So realistically,
sounds generous.
Me being 2 inches taller than a guy that is a professional basketball player, you know, that guy is a really, really good athlete if they can make it in the league at that height.
Yep.
But just to kind of fill in for those listeners that aren't as familiar with Nate, some blanks here.
Isaiah,
thank you. He's a point guard. He's a great scoring point guard. While he's short of stature, he's sturdily built, so he's got a really strong physique. He actually looks like, you know, he looks like he could play running back in the NFL maybe if he put on a few more pounds. He's not the athlete that Nate is, which Nate is like a 99.999%. you know, athlete, even amongst NBA players. But he's a guy that can get up and make plays around the rim. He's especially effective going to his left. While he wasn't considered to have a super strong outside shot as a collegiate player, he's getting better in that department. And he's kind of intriguing just because of the combination that he brings, which is a guy that can take it to the rack. He's strong enough and has a good enough handle that he can make plays close to the hoop. He's developing his right hand nicely, and he's got enough of an outside shot that he can keep defenses honest if they seg off of him. He's also got a great handle, and he's a great passer, and that it's a little hard to judge, you know, his passing on a team that's as bad as Sacramento. He's done fairly well for his first 2 years in the league.
So how about some of his stats? I mean, where does he shine, and where are the concerns?
Well, I have some thoughts with regard to plus minus. I know Rob does as well, but Rob, do you want to start off looking at his plus minus here?
Yeah, something Keith Smart's done with Isaiah this year is he's actually started playing in a lot more minutes as the year has gone on. This last month, he's averaging 28 minutes a game. The month before that, 22 minutes a game. The month before that, 18 minutes a game. A lot of that was Aaron Brooks, and then Keith Smart got smart and realized he should not play Aaron Brooks very much. His numbers are going up. So right now his overall, he's 11 points, 3.2 assists, but in the last month, now that he's getting 27 minutes a game, he's up to almost 13 points and 4.5 assists. He actually is a very good passer. He's very effective off the pick and roll. In terms of plus minus, I'm a homer. I'm a big fan of Isaiah Thomas. I'll never forget the time when he made that shot against Arizona to win the Pac-12 championship.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching the game by myself in my apartment, and I'm doing the worm all over my apartment, just going crazy.
The only way to celebrate.
Yeah.
I after he made that shot, Gus Johnson, oh, that call is so great. I chest bumped our brick wall, and then, yeah, a little bit of an injury after that. But I was looking. I am a homer, and I'm trying to find ways to make Isaiah Thomas look good. And I found stats that actually it wasn't hard to do. I found that in 2012, when he was on the court, the Sacramento Kings were a total plus minus of minus 35. So he was negative 3.7 for 48 minutes. Now, while that's not good, neither are the Kings. So I looked at the time he was off the court, and the Kings were outscored by an average of 12.8 points for 48 minutes. Making a difference of about 9 points for 48 minutes when he's playing. Getting him some more minutes, I think is a very good idea. I think that they should continue to do that because he's been great for them. So not top 5 points there, but effective.
Chris, where do you think, where is that plus minus value coming from? Which end of the floor do you think it's mostly on?
It's on the offensive end. So, I mean, he's a very good, he's a mature offensive player for somebody who's only been in the league 2 years, but his defensive, he can hold his own defensively. So, you know, his positive contribution is mostly on the offensive end, but he's not so bad on defense that he's getting destroyed. Just to kind of echo some of the things that Rob was saying, I'd say of starting guards in the league, if we look at raw plus minus numbers, only four guys were better than Isaiah Thomas, both this season and last season. So those guys are Mario Chalmers, Chris Ooh. Paul, Tony Parker, and Ed Conley in Memphis. Basically, if you look at what he's done last year as well as this year, there aren't a lot of guys in the league that are consistently better than him.
Yeah, and
raw plus minus.
And you were talking about him holding his own on defense. I mean, I'm looking at the net points per possession on defense. The Kings are 6.1 points per possession better on defense when he's on the floor than when he's off of it. Now, obviously, there are a lot of other factors involved, but one of which is that Jimmer sometimes plays his position. But, you know, that's still making a positive defensive impact.
So, I mean, if I was to make the pro Isaiah Thomas case, I'd say just, you know, as a young player in the league, his unadjusted plus-minus is excellent. And that, you know, we can watch highlight films of him where he just destroys elite guards. So, I mean, this plus minus, for example, if you go on YouTube, you can see him just kill Rondo about a month ago. And he did the same thing to Mario Chalmers when he played Miami. Again, that was a big time loss by Sacramento against Miami. But Isaiah scored, I think, 34 or 38 points in that loss. So you can get some sense for how good he is.
Speaking of highlight plays, Rob, you were watching the Kings play the Mighty Wizards the other night, and I believe Isaiah had a highlight-worthy play or two in that game, right? Can you walk us through that?
You know, it's obvious when players are small, they got to be real tough, and that's something that Isaiah is very much so. He's not afraid to go to the rack, unlike, you know, Rondo in every other game. He took one down with about a minute.
Strong words.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, Bill Simmons says it all the time. You know, he just sometimes doesn't show up and he's afraid of contact. I kind of agree. I don't watch as many games, but I trust him. So,
yeah.
Anyway, they were down, I think, 92-91 or something at this point. he took the ball down and had this just crazy sick floater that he's just mastering these days. He's getting a lot better at. It was just it was maybe a teardrop runner, if you
will. Yeah.
It looked more like a parabola than a teardrop.
Yeah. With just about a minute to go, and it was pretty awesome. And then Marcel Webster made some crazy bank shots to take the lead or to tie it up with 7 seconds to go. And then IT comes down, and the Wizards sub in, I don't even remember the guy who they subbed in. It was some dude that hadn't played the whole game. They put him on IT, and so IT is just like, all right, I'll take this, no problem. He took him to the rack, made a floater with like a second left, and they won. It was awesome. I mean, every time there's a tie game, I want the ball in his hand. It was sweet. I thought something worth mentioning is Wizards coach Randy Whitman after the game was like, I wanted to try something different. We didn't have anybody that can guard him. So that's a strong words right there for a young team that's athletic with guys like John Wall. I know Bradley Beal went out. I think he's hurt his wrist again. Still, he said that they had nobody that could guard him. So clearly he is a threat, and people are aware of him. So,
Menzel, you've been pretty quiet here. What's your take on Isaiah from a statistical perspective?
Well, I like Isaiah, and just like I liked Nate Robb before, but in general, you know, I see the league moving towards taller and taller players at almost every position. So one of the worries is that you have a guy like IT who brings a lot of positives, both kind of on the court and off. But you worry about his defense. So, I delved into his defensive numbers a little bit. And, you know, surprisingly, for such a little guy, he's got to be one of the three shortest guys in the league. He's not a guy that's getting abused in the post-up situation. You know, and there are a good number of big point guards in the West that could do this to him, you know. But at this point so far this season, we haven't really seen it happen. So I'm looking at the MySynergy Sports numbers for him. And, you know, I see that he's been down. They've taken him into the post 27 times, which is a relatively low number, just a little bit under 10% of the time. And the opponents are only scoring 0.74 points per possession in that situation. Zero fouls, zero and ones. And that's good for, like, the 52nd rank in the league. And I don't know where that ranks him in guards, but
that's excellent.
Where he gets torched, though, and this is a little bit unsurprising, is against spot-up players.
Yeah.
You know, so Isaiah is a quick guy with quick hands. He's going to be someone who wants to get into the lane and cause a little trouble. And you combine that with the fact that he basically can't close out on anybody in any circumstance. So, you know, opponents are shooting three-pointers against him, spotting up at a 50% rate so far.
Yeah.
So some of that might be a little bit of bad luck. But also I just see physically that he's not going to be the guy to close out on the shooter ever.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right about that. You know, my memory was that was also the case when he was a player in college as well. You know, and I think that we may see him sort of adjust his style of defense a little bit, you know, in the future to kind of counteract this trend. So he may be a lot more aggressive about defending guys out on the perimeter, you know, than another player because of the fact that big guards are just going to gun right over the top of him.
Yeah.
The one,
and it's tough because maybe, you know, you see that number and you think, well, maybe I want to put him on a can't shoot point guard like Andre Miller or Rondo. But then, you know, just viscerally, you see that matchup and you get terrified that you're going to get taken to the
play. Yeah, I'll say this about Isaiah, though. I mean, he's very active. He keeps his feet active. And, you know, he's a player that I think probably wears guys down over the course of a game. You know, you just see him. You're right. He can't close out on guys, but it doesn't stop him from running out and putting a hand on him when he wants to. So, you know, I think he's one of those guys with enough energy that he does have sort of a wearing down effect over the course of a game.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting that you take note of the fact that he's a strong player. I mean, that's something that I think that's a huge element to his game is just the amount of strength that he has versus a lot of NBA players that tend to be sort of taller, slender, more thinly built. He uses his strength to his advantage all the time. I mean, that's, you know, his strength combined with his first step is what gives him kind of the amazing ability to penetrate into the paint at will. That's also what lets him, sort of his quickness is what lets him score inside so effectively. So he can really turn around a screen, you know, if he gets any room coming off a screen, he's going to get into the paint and either get himself a good look close or kick out to an open shooter outside. That skill that he has, you know, based on his quickness and strength, that's something that's not going to go away anytime soon. I think that's a foundation for a long NBA career.
Yeah, I agree. I I do think he'd benefit somewhat from having DeMarcus and to a lesser extent Jason Thompson on his team, because the big men, I think, are sometimes a step late to get over to block that amazing sort of, you know, 20-foot runner that he has that seems to go up, 5 or 6 feet above the back of the backboard sometimes. You know, those shots are easier to make when the defender that might be coming over to help stop that shot is worried about DeMarcus Cousins getting the ball.
You mean on the defensive end or?
No, on the offensive end where he's trying to score.
I don't know. I mean, my thought is, I don't know this. It's just, it's sort of, my view based on watching the game so far. But I think that he might actually be hurt badly on offense by the inefficiency and the disorganization of sort of the Sacramento team. So he, by that, I mean, I look at Isaiah as having a somewhat similar skill set offensively to Chris Paul. And I think that the fact that their offensive sets are so, frankly, poorly put together really costs him assists. And mm-hmm. It costs assists basically off alley-oops and assists based off kickouts to open shooters from three. So they're really, I'd say if anything, offensively, he's being held down by his teammates rather than supported.
Yeah, Sacramento is really ISO heavy.
They're ISO heavy and they're just slow. They don't get into their sets on time. I mean, some of that is on Isaiah too. I mean, he's also at fault being the kind of the main playmaker on that team. But the fact that, Scott, you and I watched them, we couldn't believe how long it would take them to kind of get organized on offense sometimes. Like, they wouldn't really start putting a play together until there's like 12 seconds left on a clock.
Yeah.
You know, so I think
it's a frustrating team to watch.
It's difficult for me to look at that team and judge. You know, I like some of the things that Isaiah is doing. You know, if he was on a better team, maybe he'd be able to help out more and do even better. But it's very hard to judge this team based on how they're performing this year because they're frankly terrible.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know, it actually reminds me a lot of watching the old UW teams used to play for. Relatively low movement, a lot of passing the ball around the perimeter before an eventual isolation one-on-one take when I watch the Kings.
Yeah, except for the passing the ball around the perimeter part. All right, so Rob, what do you think about Isaiah going forward? I mean, do you think he's a legitimate good to great starting point guard in this league going forward?
Yeah, I would say maybe closer to good than great.
Going back to the original discussion that we had last weekend in the bar, you know, at that time I was thinking he might be a guy that would be somewhere, you know, in the 5 to 8 range, roughly. That's sort of the second tier of NBA point guards moving forward. Do you guys have any thoughts? I'm actually a little bit, I guess, cooler now than I was earlier. I look at a lot of other guards, and, you know, there's a lot of good guys in the league. You know, I'm maybe a little more hesitant to put him in that category now. What do you guys think?
Yeah, you know, I see him ultimately really as a sixth man or situational player. The player that I think of a lot when I'm thinking about the best case for Isaiah Thomas's career is actually a former Sonic, but really known as the Detroit Piston, is Vinnie Johnson, the microwave. A guy who's going to come in and just provide some just pure
heat it up
for you. Yep.
All right.
How about you, Scott?
You know, I still think that Isaiah can be a very good starting point guard. I do want to reserve judgment until he's on a team that's, a little bit more forward thinking than this one is. It is hard to judge him here. And, you know, we saw him play just an absolutely rotten game the other night against Ty Lawson and the Nuggets.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, he can let you down, but, you know, as we talked about during that game, I never thought that he would make it this far in the league, you know, to basically be the starting point guard of any team for a guy his size and sort of regarded as he was, especially when he was a young college player, is amazing. And it goes to show just, you know, what a professional he is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's,
I think he's a guy that really benefited from being, you know, number 60. And being really forced to evaluate not his game, but what he could bring to an NBA team.
One last thought from myself. I think one of the main values that he has, I don't generally believe in intangibles or off-the-court presence or whatever. You know, I tend to be more quantitative in how I evaluate players. But one thing that Isaiah has that almost no other player has in the league is that he has a history of overcoming adversity. He was the last guy picked in the draft last year. He was never thought of as a great... people in the Northwest knew of him as being a good high school guard, but they never thought he was a great high school guard. You know, and so what his accomplishments both in the league so far and throughout kind of his amateur career have really exceeded what everybody's expectations are. I think on a team like Sacramento that's full of highly drafted, highly touted players, he's the kind of guy, if he can, once he matures, if he can help these guys play together and harness their physical talents, you know, that would be an immense contribution to the team beyond, you know, what he would be able to do on the floor.
Well, I hope that's right, and I hope that if he does come to Seattle with the rest of the Sacramento Kings, that he develops along those lines. So, guys, let's talk about another stat that's relevant to point guards and maybe a little bit simpler than the four factors, and that's assist percentage. Chris, can you tell us what assist percentage is as a stat?
Yeah. So that's basically this was a stat that's been available since the 1964-65 season in the NBA. And the formula for this statistic is assists divided by minutes played. It's actually a rate. The statistics like has a couple ratios in it, but it's based on minutes played. What the heck is TMFG? I know FG is field goals. I don't know what TMs are.
So let me just hop in here. Basically, it's assuming that the number of shots taken when a guy is on the court is relative to the number of minutes they play. So if you play 24 minutes a game, they assume that half of the team's shots are taken when you're on the court.
Now that I'm looking at this equation, it seems a little obtuse or overly complicated. Is there a reason for this? I mean, this is just, you know.
Well, it has to be an approximation, right? Because the idea is that they're trying to get at it being an estimate of the percentage of a teammate's field goals. So the guys out on the floor, there's a certain number of buckets scored, and this is an attempt to figure out what percentage of those buckets he assisted on. There's not a way to absolutely determine that. And so what Menzel.
I mean, there is.
Okay.
Let's say in 1964, there might not have been an easy way.
No, there was not an easy way at that point in time.
You know, anyway, that's the equation here. I mean, the thing that's kind of interesting about it is it's a statistic that has been around for a long time. I'm just wondering, you know, what the statistic, you know, has shown us over time.
Well, you know, looking at the stats right now, you know, it's not, I'm sure, a surprise to anyone who's at the top of the list in assist percentage. It's Rajon Rondo. He's assisting on actually over 50% of his team's scores when he's on the floor. And I think probably there are people in Boston and elsewhere that would argue that that's a problem. You know, we've all seen him take assists over buckets from time to time at the very least. Meanwhile, Isaiah Thomas is not in the top 20 in assist percentage. So, you know, we'll just kind of give you a general lay of the land. Rondo is by far the highest. Menzel, do you think the stat tells us anything about teams or players?
It tells you a little bit, but, you know, what that isn't telling you is that Sacramento in general is only getting assists on, it looks like, 55% of their buckets, which is good for 29.
Which, having watched them play this weekend, does not surprise me.
Not surprising. But, you know, and then if you look at Boston, who's, you know, another 8 percentage points higher, they're fourth in the league at 63% of their buckets are assisted. You know, basically, you know, if the main problem with any type of stat that's related to assists is that ultimately the guy catching the pass has to make the shot. You know, who knows how many assists, you know, John Stockton racked up because he was able to throw the ball to Karl Malone versus, you know, guys who were throwing the ball to Benoit Benjamin or, you know, whoever it was. So, you know, assists I think are fundamentally problematic. I know there was an article that came out a few years back about how phantom assists were being awarded to Chris Paul in a lot of situations or other kind of,
I've heard that, too.
Guards who are known for their assists. So, and then, you know, the other point I want to make is that, you know, Isaiah Thomas, actually, I didn't point this out earlier. On offense, he is a player who excels as an isolation player. I think he's 16th in the league in his points per possession rating in the ISO. And so, obviously, in that situation, there's not going to be an assist. And as a scorer, he's going to be the person supposed to be in a position to put the ball in versus a guy who's a distributor or playmaker.
You know, my thought with assists are that it's a little bit like the save in baseball. So, I mean, there's kind of a subjectivity to, subject It's a subjective statistic in a lot of ways because it's basically something that is decided on by the scorekeeper oftentimes. And it's not clear, you know, if it's something that really is the most efficient way to contribute to a score. So, for example, what if Rondo didn't pass as much? Would that hurt the team, or in some cases, would it help the team? You know, I don't know. And so,
well, when he's got an open layup, there's really nothing better than that. And he's been known to pass up an open layup from time to time.
Yeah, there's been a little era that we've just gone through in basketball where I think this is kind of the anti-Allen Iverson era, where a lot of point guards kind of started to fetishize the assist rather than the points. And so maybe a little bit of an overcorrection there.
Yeah, it's maybe true. You know, I like it. You know, whatever they need to do to help the team win, you know, for me is what I hope they do.
Well, I mean, just to give some more perspective, the number two is Grievous Vasquez, but, you know, rounding out the top 10 are a lot of guys that people, you know, that's certainly an argument people would make. But if you look at who rounds out the top 10 here, you see a lot of names that are all-stars and all-star caliber players: Chris Paul, Jrue Holiday, Russell Westbrook, Tony Parker, LeBron James. So it's certainly...
Well, don't skip Jose Calderon.
I did skip Jose Calderon.
I was going to say the season's still a little young for General Grievous. You know, we all know how it worked out in the Star Wars prequel for Grievous, the Sith Lord. So maybe things won't work out for him in the same way.
No, we definitely all do not remember what happened to General Grievous in the prequels.
He died. That's what happened. Yeah.
Spoiler alert. We're going to have to bleep that out.
Wait, was he the robotic Sith Lord?
I think he was, yeah, partial robot or something. I remember there was a saber fight. He was outside the spaceship at some point.
It's an immortal story, which will be remembered for generations.
Everybody really excited to watch this movie.
I think you're thinking of the English patient, yeah. Chris. So, you know, one of the arguments that the people have about assist percentage in general, Chris, you were mentioning the subjective nature of it. And I think there's definitely something to that, but also the sort of arbitrary nature of it in the sense that we don't really know what the pass before the shot, what the value of that pass is versus the pass before that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's the concept of hockey assists. And for those that don't know, that's the pass before the pass. And right now we just don't have a way to value those.
Yeah.
Nope.
But I guess it's interesting. I don't know. Is it interesting? There's really no way to find out.
I think you know, one thing that's just another observation with a assist statistic is that players really care about it. You know, it's a great deal of guards have a lot of pride in that statistic. You know, and they follow it and they keep track of it, and it's kind of a mark, you know, mark in their career when they get a triple double. It's a mark when, you know, they hurt certain, like a thousand career assists, 2,000 career assists. And so just, you know, regardless of whether or not there's any meaning, you know, in terms of contributing to the wins and loss of a team, the assist, I think, is interesting because it's a statistic that players place a lot of value on. And so even though, it's a stat that shapes the game, even though it may not shape it in the way that we expect it to do. So anyway, I kind of wonder if that'll change over time. I mean, who knows if players follow advanced statistics and plus minus and such. But, you know, this is a stat that, you know, traditionally has been very important, especially for point guards.
And I'm sure it will continue to be. All right, guys. Well, good talks today. For those,
wait, real quick, what do you guys think of Grievous Vasquez being number two on that list?
I've long underrated Grievous Vasquez. Chris seems to think that I've been right to do that. This season, for once, I sort of feel like I've been proven wrong. But Chris, you seem to think that he's going to be falling off anytime now.
Well, I think you know, he faced that young, was it a young Luke Skywalker? I think. They had that huge lightsaber battle. It was both inside and outside an Imperial, I believe, destroyer of some sort. And
this sounds like a dream you had, I'll be honest with you. The whole young Skywalker thing's not jiving with me. The young Luke Skywalker. Maybe you're thinking of Anakin. I don't know.
It was Anakin, you're right. It was the young Darth Vader. Excuse me, I forgot. Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
I always think when you do a sequence of movies, you should start with the first one and end with the last one. You don't want to do like, you know, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, you know, minus yeah. 3, minus 2, minus 1. You know, just do it in order.
If we did things your way, we would have never had Reservoir Dogs or Memento, you know?
Yeah, that's
you're not
true.
A creative type. You're a man of science. These geniuses like George Lucas, they don't yeah. need numbers to be in order to make sense. Not like us. All right, guys. Well, I guess the answer to your question, Rob, is no one wants to talk about Grievous Vasquez.
Yeah,
I'm seriously. Sorry, but...
There you go.
There you have it. What a great way to close an analytics show, guys. Yeah. We will be back this weekend. We're having a show on Saturday. And again, for Sacramento listeners or the off chance that you're a Kings fan and still like the NBA... don't listen to that show because we're going to be talking about the Sonics to be. It's going to be a special kind of breakdown of where the team's at, the contracts, the players, the stats, the direction, and how soon we can fire the entire coaching staff. Until then, be sure to follow us on Twitter. You can follow us at Teardrop Runners, all one word, obviously. Check out our blog at teardrop.urbanishment.com. Or email us at theteardroprunners@gmail.com. Guys, go ahead and say your good nights.
Good night, everybody.
Night, everybody.
Good night, Moon.
And until next time, save us a seat at the next Sonic game.